backwards. Dotted all around on the grass were musicians playing their fiddles to the noise of the heavy drums, and in the centre was what in England Nina would have called a maypole. Though this strange arched object didn't seem anything like the twee Morris dancing memories of her childhood, this was larger, wilder, an entire caber on its end, its full green foliage promising forests and vines. Couples, she now saw, were going up to the twisted tree trunk, winding foliage around their wrists to bind them together, then unwinding themselves around the trunk until they met again, full of giggles and kisses, on the other side, whereupon the vines would be tied back onto the maying tree, and the ceremony would begin again. They must have been building it for weeks. A huge figure loomed into view, startling Nina and several of the children. It was, she realized gradually, a green man on stilts. He was completely covered in leaves and looked like he was made of the forest itself. And he was controlling the drumming, ordering and arranging the couples, in general being the master of ceremonies. More horns came round now, brimming with the strange wine, and Nina sipped at it even as she realized that it was going straight to her head, that the music and the drumming and the noise of the wind in the trees was pumping in her bloodstream, and that although she knew it was just a fundraiser for the village, an event, that was all, everything felt rich and wild and strange. She found herself gradually separated from Lennox, and borne off with the other women, all in white and some wearing masks, most with flowers and ribbons in their hair, which made it difficult to recognize anyone. And even when she did, there wasn't time for more than the briefest wave, until she was cast off again in the tide of people, laughing and dancing as children shrieked and ran in and out of their feet. She found herself making new friends and greeting old ones, and being totally unable to tell the difference between the two. It was impossible, anyway, with the noise levels and the crackle of the bonfire, to make or hear a conversation, so there was nothing to do except follow the flow. Then, bossed about by the green man, who wouldn't take no for an answer, they all had to take hands in two great rings, one clockwise, one anti-clockwise, and to the beat of the drummers and the skirl of the pipes and the fiddles, perform a strange stomping dance, around and around the bonfire, faster and faster, until Nina was utterly breathless and dizzy, overwhelmed with it all, but still laughing wildly and feeling unable to stop.
"Behold the rites of midsummer!" boomed the green man through a megaphone. "Behold the lads and lasses, and the spirit of growth and renewal, and the shortest night and the longest day. And we shall celebrate it, Mother Earth, for the fruit and flowers of your bounty."
And everyone yelled and clapped, and then the dance collapsed on the grass in heaps of giggles. But the musicians played on, their music wild and eerie on the sweet night air, with its heavy scents of lavender and wild thyme, rippling foxgloves and honeysuckle, and buttercups and maidenhair and baby's breath. For as someone had told Nina, with great seriousness and intent, she had to pick one of each type of flower, 7 flowers for 7 nights, and that would make her true love come. Once they'd all found them, the girls folded the flowers carefully into each other's hair as coronets, sipping from the horns that kept on being passed round, and as soon as they were done, the men came forward again, laughing, and grabbed their hands and made them dance. Nina was having a great time. The evening passed in a blur until finally, after 11:30, when the twilight started to deepen and the night grew chill, tartan blankets were passed out, and people huddled together next to the fire to watch the stars come out. As the sky lowered to a deep blue, not black, not up here at this time of year, suddenly the drumming stopped, and the music faded away to a mere light dance on a pipe, as if the god Pan himself was playing a haunting low tune many miles away. And then even that died away, and for an instant, in the cool air, there was a tremendous silence, as if the earth itself was holding its breath. Then, in the very far east of the night, over the sea, there was just the faintest glimmer in the dusky blue, a pale green and pink so light and subtle, it was like fingers running delicately over piano keys. There was a collective gasp from the crowd. Then suddenly everyone was stomping and cheering, people jumping up from their blankets and trying to take photographs, which rather spoiled the moment. But Nina barely noticed. She was entranced, looking at the faint, shimmering colours of the aurora borealis against the night sky. She had never seen anything so beautiful, so awe-inspiring, had never read anything quite so lovely. Then the MC shouted, and the drums and fiddles kicked off again, louder than ever, quite extraordinary. But she didn't hear them, or see everyone throw off their blankets and get up and start to dance once again around the bonfire. She was stuck, still, gazing at the sky, as people celebrated around her. Suddenly, she felt a presence at her elbow, and whirled round. Standing there, tall, silhouetted against the darkening sky, was Lennox. He said nothing, simply followed her gaze to the sky above and nodded. Then he reached out and gently touched her hand. It felt to Nina as though it burned like fire, and she snatched it away instinctively. He looked at her for a short moment, then stepped back into the whirling crowd and was gone so quickly it felt like she'd dreamed it. Hours later, Nina sat with a bunch of brand new friends, watching the sun come up when it had barely gone down, still pondering furiously on what had happened, if anything had indeed happened, or if she'd misread it. But her instincts had said, stay away. She'd been so recently burned, had thought she knew what was going on when she didn't. She couldn't get into that again. And despite the fact that that evening in the car was the first time they'd ever managed a civil conversation, she generally found him rude and curt, and she knew from what he'd told her that he was in the middle of something emotionally horrible. She thought back to Marek's big, sad puppy dog eyes, and sighed. Wasn't there somewhere out there some available guy who wouldn't completely screw her over, who would be there just for her? Or was that something only for storybooks and fantasies? Ainsley walked past. She was working there, Nina noticed, as she got up to say hello, after Ainsley helped serve the utterly splendid breakfast that was included in the ticket price, great thick jugs of fresh, creamy milk to stir into huge vats of porridge, with salt, sugar or honey, slices of locally smoked bacon in rolls, square lawn sausage, kedgeree or scrambled eggs with smoked salmon from the nearby loch, and enough tea and coffee to sober up even the midsummer crowd, although there were plenty still imbibing the pink fizzy mixture. "This is great," said Nina. "It's an amazing party." "Aye," said Ainsley. "Is it fun working here?" Ainsley shrugged. "Not really, but I need the money." "Is everything all right at home?" "Aye," said Ainsley shortly, and Nina realised she'd had too much fizz and was going too far. "Sorry," she said. Ainsley looked over her shoulder. "Who's that grumpy guy over there?" Nina glanced over. Lennox was standing by the bar, drinking whiskey. He turned back to his friends when he noticed her looking at him. "Oh, just my landlord," she said. "He's a miserable old bugger." "It's Lennox, isn't it? From Lennox Farm?" "He's dead old," said Ainsley. "He's in his early 30s. "Yeah, really, really old." "All right," said Nina. "But he's pretty cute for an older guy." Ainsley had blushed bright pink. "You think?" She nodded. "I mean, not that it matters what I think." "Ainsley," said Nina, leaning forward, "never believe that. What you think always matters." Ainsley looked at her for a moment. Then they both heard her name being called by whoever was in charge of the waitresses. "So, you're going to go for it?" she said, attempting a conspiratorial smile. "No," said Nina. "But I value your opinion." Ainsley nodded, as if it was the way of the world for her to be roundly ignored, and lumbered off into the dawn. A fleet of taxis, and cars that had been pressed into service as taxis, turned up to take the partygoers home. Several people were just flat out, and would stay that way until they woke up rather damply. Some well-prepared tents were dotted here and there. Nina felt very sobered up after about 4 pints of coffee, and shared a cab with some of the villagers she'd met there, glad that she didn't catch sight of Lennox again on her way out. Her hair had got loose, and she didn't even want to think about her eyeliner. "Did you have a good night?" asked the driver. "I always used to go as a young man. Great place to meet the lasses, oh yes."
"Did you meet any?"
said a very drunk girl squashed into the back seat.
"Met my wife," said the cabbie. "She won't let me go any more, unless I'm working. It was fun, though. Did you get the lights tonight? I've never seen them in the summertime."
"They were amazing," said Nina, thinking back. If she forgot about that awkward moment with Lennox, it had been, in many ways, the most marvellous evening. She recalled nights out she'd had in the city. Yes, it was definitely true. There was no comparison. She might not go out as often here, but when she did, it really meant something. She wished Sarinda had been there. She'd have loved it. And the Gus had been asking after her, too. She didn't think he'd ended up with anyone either. But now, as she sank gratefully into bed, after taking off the lovely dress and checking it for marks, fortunately, she appeared to have got away relatively unscathed, just some mud here and there. She'd need to look out a lovely set of new books for Leslie to say thank you, especially now she knew what she liked. Her memories weren't of the wild dancing or the sweet wine or the shimmering lights across the horizon. They were, disagreeably, of the look on Lennox's face when she'd snatched her hand away, and a growing, uncomfortable knowledge of what she'd felt wasn't dislike or fear or anything like that, which she suspected had shown on her face. She had pulled her hand away because what she had felt, the very second he had touched her, even lightly, was heat. Deep, instantaneous, burning heat. It had seared her. She didn't want to, couldn't think about that now. The trouble she could cause as she was on the point of losing her home, of losing everything she'd worked so hard to build. And she never cast a thought, never even considered that a couple of miles to the west, a train had stopped, sat idling on a level crossing as the driver leaned his head out of the window beside an empty tree, and also gazed up at the astonishing lights in the sky, and thought that no one but he had ever felt so lonely.
Chapter 25 The morning sun fell across her bedspread as Nina woke late, but arose feeling oddly better, considering how much she'd drunk and danced the evening before. After a long soak in the bath, using the incredibly expensive bubble bath and smellies that had been left out in a basket, like a posh hotel, and which she'd never dared use before, she cared less now if she was en route to eviction. She even felt cleansed. As long as she didn't think about Lennox. She blinked as she sat down and combed out her hair. This was terrible. This was a truly awful idea. He was a vulnerable man, in Wellington's, for God's sake, who had lowered his guard for one night, who had himself said he wanted to get drunk. He was almost certainly every bit as embarrassed as she was this morning, probably more so. The best, the only thing to do was to ignore him, because if he had to walk in here one day, soon, and tell her that she was being evicted, and that Kate was getting the entire farm, well, she was going to have to deal with that. She looked at a computer to see another friendly message from Orkney Library, suggesting she go up and have a look around, and saying that the northern lights were particularly tremendous this year, which made her smile. Perhaps she ought. Anything to get out of the way for a few days. To leave everything behind would be so hard, though. She thought back to the antics of the night before, and smiled. Couldn't help it. But then, that was the Scots, wasn't it? Endlessly welcoming and hospitable, particularly up here. It didn't necessarily mean she belonged, did it? But she didn't know what else to do. She didn't want to hang around, moping on the farm. She really didn't want to see Lennox. No. She might feel strange, but she'd get out, make some money, stock up the van, make sure everything was in tip-top condition. Try to see herself as a rolling stone, someone who liked moving on, who liked to travel and keep going. Even though it was Sunday and none of the shops in the village were open, she decided to get out there anyway. The sooner the better. And also, she realized, the further away she was from Lennox and his stupid farm, the better right now. The idea that he might pop over and apologize made her feel embarrassed and awkward. She remembered again the look on his face when he'd first seen her in her white dress. No, she told herself. She was imagining things, again, as she always did, as Sarinda kept pointing out. It was nothing. Or at the very best, it was a lonely, angry man, wondering if she'd oblige because she only lived up the hill, and that wasn't at all what she was after either. Then her traitorous thoughts strayed again to the feeling of his strong, large, calloused hand on hers. No, 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 no. Moving on. She was moving on. This wasn't her home. They wouldn't really notice. It was a stopping point, that was all. A way of getting her out of an unsatisfying career and into an interesting one. Life would go on here, and she would go elsewhere, and no one would miss her. Actually, it turned out, since the weather was still holding, almost unheard of for this part of the world, the little village was absolutely thronged, people everywhere exploring the historic cobbled streets. The pub had thrown open its doors, and Edwin and Hugh waved merrily to her, perched at wooden tables set up outside, both of them nursing their usual pint of 80 shilling. She stopped off for a chat, as she normally did, and presented them with her latest finds. A Cold War submarine thriller for Edwin, which he adored, no matter how similar they ended up to one another, and a contemporary rom-com for Woolly, of all people, who had accidentally stumbled across one, and now adored the entire genre, notably unfazed when teased about how many pink-jacketed books he was reading. And as Nina looked around the little village in the sunshine, she couldn't help but notice something. Everyone was reading. People out in their gardens, an old lady in her wheelchair by the war memorial, a little girl absent-mindedly swinging on the swings, her feet dangling, completely engrossed in what Katie did. In the bakery, someone was laughing at a book of cartoons. At the coffee stand, the barista was trying to read and make someone a cappuccino at the same time. Nina was amazed. It couldn't be, surely, that she had turned an entire town into readers. And yet, as she opened up the little shop of Happy Ever After, and more people came cheerfully out of their houses, exclaiming that she was open on a Sunday, it seemed that she had. "The kids have almost stopped playing Minecraft," said Hattie. "Of course, they just want to read books about Minecraft, but that's still a miracle as far as I'm concerned."
"I don't even know when I stopped reading," an elderly man confessed, picking up one of the most beautiful editions of Sherlock Holmes Nina had ever seen.
She hated selling it, and had stuck a huge price on it in the hopes that she wouldn't have to, but it appeared that she did. Still, it would help for her moving fund, she thought sadly.
"I think I just stopped seeing books around," the man went on. "You know, on the bus, everyone used to read books, but then they were fiddling with their phones, or those big phones, I don't know what they're called."
"They were probably reading on their tablets," said Nina, loyally. She loved her e-reader, too.
"Yes, I know," said the man, "but I couldn't see. I couldn't see what they were reading, or ask them if it was good, or make a mental note to look for it later. It was as if suddenly, one day, all the books simply disappeared."
Nina looked at him. "I know what you mean," she said. "I do. I know how you feel." They both admired the Sherlock Holmes, with its hand-tooled leather cover and beautiful watered silk endpapers.
"You don't want to let go of this, do you?" said the old man.
"Not really," said Nina, honestly.
"I'll look after it, I promise."
"Okay," said Nina, taking his cheque and putting it into her old tin cash-box.
"You can come and visit it from time to time if you like,"
said the old man, with a slightly flirtatious tone. Nina grinned at him. "Oh, I'm not sure how long I'll be around," she said, and tried to make it sound careless and light-hearted, although she did not think she succeeded. She was sitting, trying to unobtrusively watch mucky little Ben sitting on her steps, quietly sounding out a book with his lips moving, his eyes shooting up every 10 seconds in case anyone was passing or saw him, when Ainsley came up and scowled at him.
"Don't run out the house. I thought yous were lost."
"As no lost.
Yeah, I can see that now, but you can't just up and go and no tell me."
Nina frowned. Now Ainsley was hissing at him.
"If they see you, if they see you wandering the streets, Benny."
"I dinny care."
"You will."
"I dinny."
He looked back down at his book, and Ainsley sighed in exasperation and turned her attention to Nina.
"I didn't know you were open today."
"I'm not really," said Nina. I just I just came down to... She didn't know how to explain what was going on, and changed the subject. Didn't you like the midsummer party? It was lovely. Ainsley shrugged. It was boring. There were lots of nice boys there, said Nina, trying to raise a smile but not succeeding. Ainsley looked around grumpily. There's nothing to do. I know, said Nina, who'd had a flurry of anxiety-displacing tidying. Honestly, I don't need you today. Ainsley shrugged and set off again into the bright market square, her heavy black eye makeup and badly dyed hair looking strange in the morning sunlight.
Come on, Ben,
she snapped, and the little boy reluctantly put the book down, Nina would wipe it for fingerprints later, and trailed behind her, head down. It was then that Nina made the decision. She had held off for long enough, and if she wasn't going to be here for long, it didn't matter if people thought she was a busybody. She waited an instant, then quietly closed and locked the doors of the van and slipped down the street, following the pair. The village wound on through its cobbled central section and dribbled off into less attractive streets at the bottom. Grey-built 1950s social housing, some of which was smart and lined with flowers, and some of which was a little tattier, though it all overlooked beautiful green fields with long views across the countryside. Even if you were skint, Nina couldn't help thinking, it was still obviously the loveliest place in the world to grow up. Ainsley and Ben turned in at the most broken-down-looking house of all. Rubbish was scattered all over the front scrub, as well as an old armchair without legs and some broken toys. There was only dirt on the ground. The door was covered in scratches and dents. The glass in the windows was cracked. It was completely unloved and uncared for. Nina swallowed. She realized suddenly that she was quite frightened. In her darkest scenarios, she imagined Ainsley kept in by some horrible stepfather, or a family on substances who couldn't be bothered to look after the children. She didn't know if she had the courage for this. She was used to having to deal with various social problems in the library. They would often have a quiet word with social services if the same people were coming in every day and falling asleep, obviously without anywhere else to go, or if their regulars were becoming increasingly unkempt. And many people used the library as a kind of informal citizens' advice bureau anyway, so they tried not to mind. But this was different. She was poking her nose in. It was undeniable. She tried to comfort herself with the thought that it was about a child, after all, a child who wasn't well looked after, who wasn't clean, who could barely read at the age of 8, who wasn't attending school. And Ainsley, too, who only came alive when alone with her books, whose lack of interest in everything else in life seemed to indicate a real issue somewhere, more even than for normal teenage girls. Nonetheless, Nina still felt like a busybody, someone inserting herself into other people's lives, making herself a nuisance, the city girl turning up where she wasn't wanted, poking about where she didn't belong. It had been different back in the library, where people asked for help or were genuinely grateful for it. However carefully she'd tried to probe, Ainsley clearly didn't want to discuss it. But there was a child involved. She sighed, twisting in indecision. What was right? To stay or to go? Ainsley was functioning, wasn't she? Although Nina thought back to that awful conversation about her not sitting her exams. That wasn't right, a clever girl like her. She should be looking at universities, thinking about what fun she was going to have when she left home, not slouching around the place, shouting at her brother and planning absolutely nothing for the future. Maybe Nina could just have a gentle conversation with the parents, try and convince them what a clever girl they had on their hands. Yes, that would do it. That would be it. Boldly, she walked forward to the gate. The handle was broken, and the gate sat balanced gingerly on its hinges. She slipped through it carefully and walked up the cracked stones of the garden path. The road was eerily silent, empty of cars. A lone kestrel lazily circled the air above the trees. Nina watched him for a moment, in awe of his silent majesty, and slightly envious of his uncomplicated social obligations. Then she stepped up to the door and knocked, briskly, before she had the chance to change her mind. Chapter 26. For a long while there was silence. There weren't any lights on inside the house. If Nina hadn't watched them both go in, she would have thought it was empty. Then, at last, there was a shout Nina recognized as Ainsley's, but it sounded something like, "Don't answer it!" It was too late, however, as a small, grubby hand was already drawing back what sounded like several bolts from the other side of the door.
"Nina!"
Ben's sticky face was unable to hide his delight, and the smile that cracked his face made him unrecognizable from the sullen little boy she'd met for the first time on the steps of the van.
"Hi, Ben. Have you got some books for me?"
Nina cursed herself for not having thought of this.
"No, sorry, I didn't. I should have brought some. Yes, I do, but they're at the van," she improvised quickly. "Is your mum in?"
Ben's face immediately became evasive, and he glanced to the left. Looking behind him, Nina could see an incredibly messy kitchen, covered in rubbish and old milk containers. The house smelled of dust, neglect, and something underneath it she couldn't quite identify.
"Ben, who is that?"
came Ainsley's voice. She appeared behind her brother and squinted at Nina standing out in the sun.
"What do you want?"
The normal, quiet deference in Ainsley's voice had completely vanished. She sounded bolshy, cross, and ready to throw Nina out. Suddenly, Nina realized that Ainsley was substantially physically bigger than her, and quite capable of doing so if she fancied.
I just wondered, is your mum in?"
Ainsley and Ben looked at each other.
"What's it to you?"
said Ainsley rudely.
I just wanted to tell her how great I think you're doing, that's all. You left without your wages, and I wanted to make sure you got them." "You didn't just come here for a sticky beak?"
Nina didn't know how to answer this, so she looked down.
"We're fine," said Ainsley. "We don't need your charity." "It's not charity," said Nina. "It's your wages. You earned them."
Ainsley looked torn.
"Please," said Nina. "Please, Ainsley. I don't mean any harm, I promise. I don't want to cause trouble. I just wanted to make sure everything was all right."
Her eye was caught by a sudden movement behind the children. It was a mouse, a huge one, either a mouse or a rat, she thought, and she knew straight away that she couldn't leave. She looked up at Ainsley, who had clearly come to the same conclusion. She let out a great sigh and heaved her shoulders.
"Can't tell anyone you've been here," she said.
"Okay,"
said Nina, not even bothering to cross her fingers. Something was clearly not working here, and she was determined to find out what it was.
"I'll just come in for a minute. You canny? Is your mother here or not?"
Suddenly, there was a small noise. It was a tinkling bell. Everyone looked at each other. Ben was hopping up and down, unable to control himself.
"Ains," he was saying, tugging her jumper. "Let her come in. She's nice."
Ainsley stared straight back at Nina as if she'd never seen her before.
"I won't stay long,"
said Nina in a calm tone. She needed to be here. She stepped over the threshold.
"Mrs. Clark,"
she called out softly.
"Mrs. Clark."
And in response, the bell tinkled once more. The sitting room smelled, in the local parlance, fusty. Dusty, old and tired. There were piles of papers and books everywhere. Nina looked at them.
"This looks like exam homework to me," she said.
Ainsley shrugged, unsmiling. The nervous, eager-to-please girl from the van had gone. In her place was someone far more truculent and intransigent, and she did not respond. Nina looked around and cleared her throat.
"Ahem," she said. "Where's your mum?"
The door was badly warped, and Nina had to push it quite hard to make it open. The room was at the back of the house, decorated in old pink textured wallpaper, heavy and ridged. There was a smell of talcum powder, and, heavier, the scent Nina had detected before and now recognized, the smell of illness.
"Hello?"
As she stepped into the room, the figure in the bed turned its head, painfully slowly. Nina nearly gasped. It was an old woman, wizened and completely ancient. Then she looked closer and realized that the woman wasn't that old, but that her face was marked with deep lines of pain, her neck twisted at a strange angle.
"Hello,"
she said in a very soft, gravelly voice. still with the Highland musicality that sounded as if she was having trouble finding the breath for it.
"Excuse me for not getting up.
Are you Mrs. Clark?
Are you from the social?"
"No," said Nina.
"The school? I had a word with the school."
"No, no, I'm not from the school. I'm from the book bus."
"Oh, that van," said the woman.
Her breath rattled as she spoke. She looked intensely unwell.
"I heard about it. It sounds great."
I'll bring you something to read," said Nina.
She risked a step closer.
It's just I was a bit worried about Ben.
Oh, he's quite the tearaway,"
said Mrs. Clark slowly. Every word seemed to be torn from her throat. The room felt oppressive, and Nina's skin prickled. She forced herself to move closer to the bed.
"I'm sorry," she said, "but what's wrong with you?"
"MS," said the woman. "I have good days and bad days, you know."
She didn't sound like she had good days. Nina moved closer.
"But you should be able to get up and about in a wheelchair with MS," she said. "Do you have someone coming in to help you?"
"No,"
came a sharp voice behind Nina's back. She turned. It was Ainsley, eyes bright and burning.
"No, we don't need anything like that."
Nina blinked.
"But some social services care. Someone to help look after you."
Ainsley shook her head sternly.
"What? Have some interfering little busybody come in and tell me I can't look after me own mum? No chance."
"That's not what they do," said Nina. "They help with the cleaning and..." "I'm not 16," said Ainsley fiercely.
"You know what they'd do? They'd pack us off to a children's home. Me and Ben to separate homes. Have you heard what goes on in those types of places?"
Nina nodded.
"But it wouldn't be like that. I'm sure they'd do everything they could to keep you at home with your mum, or to keep you together."
"No, they wouldn't," said Ainsley. "I can look after her. I can look after her just fine."
Her voice was tight.
"She's a great girl," said the woman in the bed.
"I know," said Nina. "I know she's a great girl. She works for me, too. But honestly, she should be sitting her exams, and Ben needs to go to school every day when they start back."
"I don't want to,"
came a loud voice from outside.
I know,
said Mrs. Clark, letting out a deep, retching cough.
"But I need them so much. When we're all together, we just curl up on the bed, and we don't need anyone else. And we have a nice, cozy time. We don't need to go anywhere, do we? They're not nice at that school anyway."
Ainsley nodded. "We're fine."
Nina moved forward.
"There are definitely things that can be done. It can absolutely be better than this, I promise."
"But I need them,"
said the woman plaintively. Nina shook her head.
"You need help," she said, "but not from them."
"They're my family."
"They are," said Nina, "but they have to have their own lives too."
There was a silence, and Nina was horrified to see a tear start to steal down Mrs. Clark's waxy cheek.
"I'm so sorry," she said. "I didn't mean to upset you."
"No,"
said the woman.
"It's all right for you. You're not ill. You haven't got kids who love you. You don't know what it's like."
Nina shook her head.
"I don't," she said. "But there has to be a better way than this. You deserve people who can look after you properly."
She could feel Ainsley bristling behind her and stood stock still. Mrs. Clark sighed.
"Ainsley used to be so good, didn't you, Ainsley? He was happy to do it all, cleaned and changed the beds and made the dinner. I don't know why you stopped."
She looked around as if seeing the horrible mess for the first time.
"I don't even know how it got so bad.
Ainsley let out a sigh.
Haven't you been making Ben go to school?
Said the woman.
He has to go to school, Ainsley. You used to be so good at it.
Aye, said Ainsley. Aye, but that was all I ever did. That was all I was ever going to do. Be your slave. Be stuck here forever. Cleaning and washing and scrubbing. I don't want to do that. I want to do other things.
She looked angrily at Nina.
I like working for her.
Mrs. Clark's tears were falling swiftly now.
But I thought, you always said you didn't mind. Because I didn't want them to take me away, or Benny. But I thought, when I was little, I thought you were going to get better. I didn't realise you were always going to be the same, forever. I didn't know that I was going to be here forever.
Both of them were crying now, and Mrs. Clark reached out a hand. Ainsley took it and grasped it hard.
We can fix it,
said the woman, looking at Nina.
Can't we?
Nina looked around. Well, I think I know where we can get started, she said. She couldn't get Ben to stay in the house with his mother and sister. Instead, he trailed after her, asking lots of questions in a frightened voice. Nina tried to placate him as best she could, then finally got him to keep quiet by letting him sit up front in the van, which he absolutely loved. Even better, he saw some of his school friends playing in the swing park, and Nina let him honk the horn so they all turned round and he waved furiously. Nina smiled, seeing how quickly the mood of an 8-year-old could turn. At the farm, she jumped down and ran into the barn, gathering up all the heavy-duty cleaning materials she'd bought for mucking out the van, and a host of thick black bin bags for good measure. As she was loading them into the back, Lennox strode across the farmyard, Parsley at his heels. He stopped when he saw her, went slightly pink, then cleared his throat.
"Hey," he said, drawing closer. "What's all that for? Have you run someone over and tried to get rid of the evidence?"
Nina flushed too, and told herself not to look at those long, strong, hard-working fingers, not to think about them and wonder what they could do. No, she wouldn't, nor his blue eyes drilling into her.
No,
she said. She didn't want to explain.
"Is that Ben Clark?" he said, nodding at the front of the van. "Hey, Ben, how's your mum? Hang on."
He disappeared into the farmhouse and reappeared with a bowl of eggs. "Want to take these to her?"
"You knew about his mum?" said Nina,
suddenly enraged.
"What, Mrs. Clark? I heard she'd been a bit poorly, but it's nothing too serious, is it?"
"She's completely bedbound," said Nina. "Ainsley and Ben have been covering for her for months, maybe years. Ainsley's a child carer, didn't you know?"
Lennox looked at her.
"I try and keep out of people's business," he said. "Hoped they'd keep out of mine."
Said Nina.
"Are you do-gooding?"
"Well, you appear to be do-nothing, so I might as well."
Lennox sniffed suddenly and marched off. Nina watched him go, wishing she hadn't flown off the handle with him. She didn't understand what on earth seemed to get her all riled up every time she saw him. Ainsley complained bitterly, even when Nina took out her second bag and revealed 2 packets of chocolate digestives, bananas, tea, ice cream, and a large bottle of iron brew.
"The harder you work, the more treats you get," she said, smiling.
"I'm not four."
"I know," said Nina, "but I'll pay you your wage for this if you like."
Ainsley immediately sparked up a little, and they rolled their sleeves up and got to it. Ainsley lifted her mum out of bed whilst Nina stripped the sheets and hurled everything she could find into the washing machine. Many of the clothes were badly mildewed, and she took away what couldn't be salvaged, or cut it up for rags. She'd find them other clothes somehow. Once all the rubbish was removed, the house looked miles better already, and they washed, polished and scrubbed, filling bin bag after bin bag that Nina would then take to the dump. Little Ben, grubbier than ever, helped pick up and tidy away, and was even persuaded to put his broken bits of toys into a box when Nina promised him she would get him new ones. She wasn't entirely sure how she'd be able to afford that, but she'd think of something. She got him hoovering and washing windows, where a few streaks here and there weren't really going to matter. Then she set about, with Ainsley, opening the exhausting forms and official letters that had been dumped and piled up haphazardly on the kitchen table.
"Oh, Ainsley," she said, "no wonder things are so hard. Look, they're asking for proof of all sorts of things, and they're going to stop your money."
She picked up one letter asking Janine Clark to attend a fitness-to-work assessment.
"Oh, for crying out loud," she said. "This is nuts." "I didn't know what to do," said Ainsley. "I couldn't get her up, and it's two buses away, the assessment centre. I mean, you can't get there for 10 o'clock in the morning, even if you could walk. And she can't work. I didn't know."
"Why on earth aren't social services more on to you?" wondered Nina. "You guys have just fallen down a crack. You don't bother anyone and they don't bother you."
"That's how we like it," grunted Ainsley.
"But it isn't, though, is it? It hasn't been for a long time."
Ainsley shook her head.
"It's going to get better," vowed Nina.
"Don't."
Ainsley was furiously pink.
"I know you've helped us in that, and we're grateful and everything. But don't go telling people in the village. I don't want charity. I don't want clothes from the charity shop and school uniform from the leftovers bin."
Nina shook her head.
"I understand, okay? I don't want handouts, please."
"Okay," said Nina. "I'll see what I can do. But Ainsley, you have to sit your exams. You're such a bright girl, and you could do really well. If we managed to get you all set up here, you could go far and make a much better life for your mum.
Without me?"
Nina had to admit she had a point.
"Well," she said, "let's just take it as it comes."
"It's all right for you to say. You just turned up out of nowhere. You'll probably move on again as well, won't you?"
Nina didn't have an answer to that. The emergency social workers were tremendous. They breezed in and assessed the situation instantly, making a special point of congratulating Ainsley on the wonderful job she'd made of being a carer, and telling her repeatedly that that was what she was, as well as somehow conjuring up a large box of new Lego for Ben. He sat on his mum's bed, happily putting it together, with a skill and concentration Nina would not have expected of him. She avoided Lennox when she got home, utterly exhausted, grubby to the bone, but with a feeling of pleasant exhaustion, of deserving her hot bath. She wasn't going to consider him a bit, she decided. The man had been so wrapped up in his own problems, he hadn't even noticed those on his doorstep.
Chapter 27. The summer stretched on. There were great, heaving, stormy days, when the clouds lay on the very top of the van and the rain poured down, leaving the meadow grass bent low under its weight. But equally, there were glorious, bursting days, when the sun rose golden and pink ahead, and the wind blew soft and warm, tiny clouds scudding across the sky, rabbits everywhere, and the vast scent of hay rising from the fields and perfuming the air made the whole world feel fresh and washed clean. Most importantly, there wasn't a day when Nina could imagine being anywhere else. The axe had not fallen yet, because what had seemed an easy thing to say, "Of course I'll keep moving, of course I'll go to Orkney," was, she realised, in fact, not at all easy. As she tracked down people's favourites, coped with the overspill of the now incredibly well-attended toddler story sessions, she could have done 10 a week had she been so inclined, and struggled to get down the main street without saying hello to about 60 people, in a way that made her think this must be a little what being famous was like, it struck her that it would be very hard to give this place up. Because despite everything, she couldn't deny it. She was happy. Ainsley was turning up regularly to work, amazed that social services had been so kind, so understanding and helpful, had actually sent someone round who could help them with the cleaning. Ainsley was so close to her 16th birthday, and her mum had made such an effort to be engaged and make sure Ben went to school, she had fervently promised to stop keeping them off and tucking them up in bed with her, although it did mean, Nina had noticed inadvertently, that Ben had the most tremendous in-depth knowledge of 1980s teen movies, that although there was a case conference coming up, it was highly likely that the whole family would be allowed to stay at home together. Ben now was attending the local summer play scheme every day, more or less. Occasionally, on a particularly beautiful day, Nina would notice him heading Tom Sawyer-like for the river, and would tip Ainsley off, with a slight tinge of regret at having to curtail his freedom.
He'd also caused her to break her most adamant rule, the one she had sworn never to be moved on, to never, ever lend a book. Occasionally she would offer to buy back particularly lovely editions if they were in great condition, but no, she was not a library service. She had to live and eat and pay people. Edwin and Hugh got preferential rates, and Ainsley had her staff discount, but everyone else absolutely had to pay. Otherwise she couldn't get by. Except Ben. The child, once unleashed, could not be held back. He tore through the Faraway Tree books, Harry Potter, the Adventure Series, Swallows and Amazons. He read like a dam bursting, and Nina couldn't find it in her to deny him a word. He was an endlessly familiar sight that summer when the play scheme was out, running errands for his mum, then settling himself in the sun on the step like a cat. With the help of the overworked local headmistress, who was just desperately relieved to be on her break and filling it with a selection of books called things like Breaking Out of Teaching and My Life as an Astronaut, Nina was gently and discreetly talking to Ben about how much fun Primary 4 was and how many people had moved into the village, so there'd be lots of new kids there who really didn't know who anyone was. She told him about the trips they would be going on, and how they did all sorts of amazing things like growing frog spawn into tadpoles and frogs. And when the book bus was quiet, which wasn't often that summer, as the village filled up with walkers and hikers and people who wanted local maps and local history and simply something to enjoy in the sunshine with a pint of local ale or to keep them company whilst the rain hosed sideways on their tents all night and they decided to spend their next holidays in the Gobi Desert, she made Ainsley take out her geography and history textbooks and work away quietly in the corner of the bus, just a little bit. Her effort was partly for the family, Nina knew, but more selfishly, and deep down, it was something for her, so that even if her romantic life was a disaster, even if her hopes of staying here turned to dust and she had to move to the islands, even with all of those things, she hadn't done nothing. Chapter 28 Nina spent less and less time at the farm as the little shop of Happy Ever After became even busier. After her first disastrous attempt, which involved quite a lot of thrown raisins and a keeler hitting the roof, reading cubs had become intensely popular. The toddler group never went out of fashion, and book groups were springing up all over the place. Nina would try and find the best of the absolute best for the groups, rather than suggesting something new and expensive, while the little ones liked absolutely anything by Maurice Sendak. "Imagine," she direct messaged to Griffin one night, "going into a publisher's these days and saying, 'I'm drawing this picture book of a young naked boy with his knob out getting baked into a cake. Yes, sugar for breakfast, by 4 Oliver Hardys.'"
"You sound weird," Griffin had replied.
"I'm working a lot of overtime," she typed back. "I only think in books. So I'm working too hard, and it's like hard times. Then I go home, and it's Cold Comfort Farm."
"I wish I could think in books," typed back Griffin glumly. "We're not allowed to think about books at all. It's all about social media presence."
"Microserfs?"
"Oh, God, they're all too young even to have heard of it. Everyone is 23, and they keep trying to get me to come nightclubbing."
"I thought you were loving all that."
"I'm exhausted," he typed back, "and at risk of alcoholic liver disease. All they do is shout, 'Awesome!' at everything. I hope it keeps up till my appraisal. Of course, you don't have anything like that to worry about any more."
"No," typed Nina. "No holiday pay either, or sick pay, or days off."
"Boo-hoo-hoo, James Herriot. I've got a 10-page confluence scheduling report to do. I don't even know what that means."
They'd logged off, and Nina had sighed and tried to go back to reading and feel better that way, but all she could find were romantic heroes that reminded her of Lennox if they were gruff and uncommunicative, or Marek if they were sweet and cheerful, until she thought she was going completely mad. She was restless, not sleepy, and decided she could take a walk. She could, down her old paths, without getting too maudlin about it. He wouldn't be there, he wouldn't stop, and even if he did, there was nothing more to say. But the exercise might help her sleep, might even give her hope that one day there would be somebody else, that not all romance was dead, that sometimes, maybe, it was just bad timing. Parsley barked hopefully as she left, but she passed him by and scattered the chickens to wander the lanes by herself. The hawthorn was in full bloom, its scent heavy on the fresh night air. Nina pulled her coat tighter around her and walked on. It was better, she felt, better to be out and about, pondering her future, than sitting indoors in a beautiful home that did not belong to her, and soon wouldn't belong to Lennox either, that would be snatched away by a woman who did not want it, who did not want lovely Kirrenfeef, or the farm, or the little Murcott Cross, or the bunting that festoons the town square in midsummer, who didn't want any of it, who would turn it into money and fritter it away. Crossly, she dug her hands into her pockets. She could look for somewhere else round here, she supposed, but nobody had anywhere apart from a spare room above the pub, which she really didn't want, and certainly it would be nothing like as nice. Meanwhile, Orkney had said there was a lovely vacant farmhouse she could rent, all mod cons, super cheap rent. And by the way, if she could bring 20,000 to 30,000 other young people to help repopulate the islands while she was at it, that would be great, thanks. She sighed at the dilemma and stomped on. Before she knew it, she was approaching the level crossing, her heart full of regrets. When she saw the tree, she stopped and gasped. It was completely covered in books, all tied to the branches with shoelaces, cascading down like low-hanging fruit. It was strange and oddly beautiful, a tree full of books on a deep blue summer's night, in the back end of absolutely nowhere at all. Nina stared at it. "Oh, Marek, what on earth have you done?" she thought. There was history, fiction, poetry, many of the books in Russian or Latvian, but some in English. Several were waterlogged, which meant they had been there for a little while, and some pages had come loose and plastered themselves to the trunk, which had the added effect of turning the tree itself into a huge book made of papier-mâché. As Nina stood back and gazed, entranced, a breeze passed by, and the books spun and danced in the wind, paper back to pulp, back to the wood where it had once begun. "Oh, my," she breathed to herself and pulled out her phone. Then she put it away again. No. No, she wouldn't. She couldn't. She glanced at her watch. It wasn't long. Not long until the train was due. Maybe it couldn't hurt to see him once more before she left, just to say thank you, maybe. His feelings, she saw now, were much stronger than she'd realized. But weren't they too just the yearnings of a lonely, romantic heart? And shouldn't two hearts like that be together? No. Absolutely not. There was a little boy involved. There was a family. She wouldn't do that to anyone else's family. She couldn't. She swallowed hard. So, she would turn around. She would walk away. In the distance, she heard the quiet note of the low whistle, the delicate rattling she'd come to know so well, and her heart started to beat in time with the rhythm of the rails. Chapter 29. It was as if she was frozen to the spot. Slowly, the train came up the line, trundling its precious trucks behind it, and throwing caution to the wind, she ducked under the barrier and waved her arms hugely, flapping them as if she had no idea what she was doing, as the train slowed down and down. Heart pounding, she tried to think what she was going to say. Simply, no, or it's not possible, or a proper goodbye. A sad look at chances missed and timing gone wrong. She stood there, stock still now, blinking. A million different things racing through her mind. Jim was up in the cabin, and she called his name. He didn't look round. He didn't even seem to be stopping. But at last he did, just further down the line, so that Nina was directly facing the very last truck, the one with the little balcony on the back. Marek was sitting on it, his legs dangling, not in his uniform, in plain clothes. She looked up at him. "Hey," she said, unsure what to do. "Hey," she said again, stepping forward, as he still didn't meet her eye. "The tree," she said.
The tree, it's so beautiful, but... I mean, it's lovely, but...
He stood up.
Nina,
he said, and his voice was sad and low.
I came to say goodbye.
Why?
Said Nina.
Why? Where are you going?
Oh, I got in trouble. Slowed the sleeper too many times, yes?
No, said Nina. They're not. You didn't lose your job.
Marek shrugged.
No picnics on the railway, he smiled. It was all my fault.
No, Nina said. You can't. You can't get fired. Won't they go on strike for you?
A thought struck her.
Is that why Jim isn't talking to me?
He is very cross with you, said Marek. He blames you for everything.
Oh, God,
said Nina in agony.
I'm so sorry. I really, really am so, so sorry.
Marek shook his head.
Was not your fault. Was not Nina.
I didn't help,
said Nina miserably, thinking of all the huge favours she'd let him do for her, how she'd encouraged him to play fast and loose with his job.
Won't the men come out for you, though?
Of course, said Marek. I am good train engineer, who does naughty things sometimes, but...
There was a pause.
Will you get another job?
Oh, no, said Marek. No, no. No job. I cannot stay in Britain, huh?
Nina was horrified.
Oh, my God, she said. You're being deported. You can't be deported.
She swung onto the railway line and climbed up the steps.
Even this is naughty, said Marek.
I don't care, said Nina hotly. They can't deport you. Let me take the blame.
Maybe it is time, said Marek sadly. I was fooling myself, playing that I was in a romance with you, huh? A big storybook romance, like the poets write.
Nina looked at his huge, dark eyes and spiked lashes, and felt her own eyes fill with tears.
But you were right. It was not real. I have a life. Everybody does. And my life is Aras and Bronya. This is pretend life. I want real life.
His face was full of pain.
You're going, said Nina.
Marek nodded.
Oh, yes. I am going home. I will find a job. I can fix engines, many types of engines. There are always jobs for people who can fix engine.
Nina blinked.
But, she said, but...
Without warning, there was a loud honk. Jim had started to move the engine.
Goodbye, said Marek.
Nina stared at him. The great train was starting to move.
Get down, Nina, said Marek. Get down. It's not safe.
But,
said Nina, the train was starting to gather speed.
Go.
She looked at him one last time. Then she jumped and landed safely by the side of the track and watched the huge, long, rolling stock push its way through the valley and slowly slide on until it was out of sight. Standing by the railway line, she tried Marek's number with a pounding heart, but there was no answer. She hammered out a text message to him, but again, no reply. She rang Sarinda.
I knew this was stupid,
she sobbed down the phone, and Sarinda, to her eternal credit, didn't say, I told you so, when she'd have been well within her rights to do so.
I thought it was, well, it was romantic. It was sweet. It was kind of a game.
He lost, said Sarinda simply, and Nina burst into sobs again. She ran all the way back to the farmyard, where Lennox, hearing her footsteps, threw open the door. His tall frame was silhouetted in the doorway, the light glowing behind him in the farmhouse, Parsley at his heels.
"What's happened? What the hell is it?"
he said, fear striking his face at her tears, his arms opening instinctively.
"Are you all right? Did something happen?"
He grabbed something from behind the door.
"What's that?"
she said, stopping short and staring at it. Lennox looked at her levelly as she took a step back.
It's a shotgun. What's the matter with you? Did someone do something to you?
Nina furiously wiped her tears away and resisted her principal urge, which was to run...